It's funny sometimes that messages will come out of the strangest place. I had an email from someone that I'd been corresponding with for a number of years. He was in prison in Texas, but he's now out, and he's attending with like-believing groups down there. But in his email, and this started a long time ago, he referred to me as his favorite spiritual cow tipper. How I got that reputation, I'm not sure. But I think he likes my articles because a lot of times I will challenge conventional beliefs, explore things a little more than sometimes we're comfortable doing. But that's how we learn. Sometimes we have to test the limits. We have to test the foundations of our belief system. And this may be good to do that. Well, I'm going to do that today a little bit. Raise yourselves. You might find one of your cows. I don't know if you know what that is. Fellows that live out in the country where there's a lot of cows, sometimes for amusement when there's nothing better to do, they'll go out in the fields at night while the cows are asleep and push them over. And they think that's just hilarious. And maybe in a way it is. I see we got a lot of young men here today. I don't want to give you any ideas. I never did it, but I know people who did. But cow tipping. It's a favorite sport of farm boys, I guess you could say. But anyhow. But that's how he referred to me. And maybe in a way it's appropriate. Now, recently I forwarded some online documentaries, which kind of factored into my decision to address this message. There were two of them. One in particular showed something that we would regard as really odd. We wouldn't think this necessarily, but it challenged the idea of the origins of our beliefs. Because they showed that the peoples in Canaan, back prior to Israel being established as a nation, they understood things that became part of the belief system that the early church and the Old Testament peoples had. And their idea is, well, we borrowed this from those people, the Canaanites, people that we would regard as pagans. And you can see how it would challenge somebody's belief system to realize that the things that we believe and teach had origins that were not from where we thought they should be from. What does that do to someone's faith? Now, we could do the same thing where it involves the Christian world. There were belief systems back before the time of Christ that advocated many of the ideas and teachings that became incorporated into the Christian religion. And I gave a message on that a few months ago about the Parthian religion, how it contained certain things that are found in our belief system today. Did we get our ideas from them? You see, that's the thing that causes people to question the validity of our teachings because, oh, if we borrowed this from paganism and we borrowed that from, and we just put it all together and made a religion out of it, what does that do to someone's confidence in their beliefs? See the problem? And I got some feedback on one of those the things that I sent out. It was particularly the one regarding the people of Canaan in ancient times. They knew and understood the name Jehovah long before they were supposed to have known it. And we have to wonder, how did they know that? Now, we tend to think back from our perspective. And we go back to the time that the Old Testament was beginning to come together, not realizing that there was a far older story than that. We know that this earth was swept clean of all false beliefs, all false societies, all false practices at the time of the flood. The belief systems that exist prior to the flood were gone. And what was left? Noah and his family. Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Genesis chapter 6, 8 and 9 tells us that. Where it says, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations. And Noah walked with God. Do you think that he might have taught his descendants? Now, Peter, in 2 Peter 2, verse 5, tells us, it talks about Noah, and he says, "And he spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly." So where did ancient peoples get their ideas about God? They had a good teacher, someone with incredible experience, who was told by God specifically how to preserve humanity through a period of time where God was basically going to erase society and start over. Do we think that Noah would have taught the truths that he understood to his descendants? Of course he would. So the knowledge of God would go clear back long before the time of Moses. But those nations that came from Noah would go out and populate and repopulate other parts of the earth, taking their beliefs with them. Now, I'm not going to suggest that they kept everything faithfully. Like any group of people, in time, they apostatize. We know that. Look at the Protestant world. There's all kinds of apostasies in Christianity where they've reflected on a few items of truth, but they've gone off in other directions and created a whole new religion, maybe peppered with points of truth here and there, but not the truth per se as a major body. We could go to almost any religion that exists. And if we look carefully enough, we will find some point of truth in there. And we have to realize that that goes way back to the time of Noah and Abraham. Okay? Abraham. In Genesis 26:5, God says, "Because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." How did Abraham have all that? Abraham did not have a Bible. Okay? He didn't. Noah didn't have the Bible. He had to have been taught directly by God, and he has to pass that teaching on to his descendants. So something interesting in Exodus 6, verse 3, it says, "And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of God Almighty, but by my name Jehovah I was not known to them." Think about that. God didn't reveal that particular name that early. And even Moses didn't know that name at first. And when he was introduced to it as its own story, and we'll get to that. Moses has this experience when he was commissioned by God to go from where he was in the land of Midian back to Egypt and to talk to the people in captivity there in Egypt and explain to them what God had given him to do. And Moses said, this is Exodus chapter 3, verses 13, "And Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come unto the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they shall say unto me, What is his name? Moses asks, What will I say to them? Verse 14, And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, Thus shall you say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. So we know two things here. Moses didn't know the name just yet, and certainly the people didn't. That sometimes challenges our presumptions that God's name was known from the very beginning. Well, it may have been with some people, but here the peoples of Israel in Egypt didn't know that particular name quite yet. There's a good reason for that. So what do we do when we find out that it appears some of the things that we take for granted seemed to have been borrowed from what we would call pagan societies? Now, we would regard a pagan as anyone not of the peoples of God, not of the Bible, the Old Testament, any belief system, we would regard it as pagan, let's face it. And they are. And I don't mean to cast a positive light towards any of these false belief systems. I'm just saying that it can be within them that there is an element of truth here and there, just as there is with modern-day religions. There's an element of truth here and there. When I was first learning the truth through the radio broadcast that I was listening to, I wrote for some literature, came to the house. My mother freaked out. She did not appreciate that source at all. And being in the Baptist church, they have this position against that particular author and that particular minister. And I had a bunch of literature stuffed in my face. And one that I remember particularly, this man's assessment of WCG and HWA was, that particular belief system, he said, is a hodgepodge of various cults. A hodgepodge of various cults. Now, that would tend to suggest that he went and he took this belief from that belief system, he took that belief from that belief system, he took that one from another, put them all together and made a religion out of it. That's the idea that this man was presenting. And from someone on the outside, you might think that that's logical to agree. The other possibility is that no, he was just going back to the basic fundamental truths of the Bible, which are scattered among many belief systems, some more, some less. That's not where it came from. It came from the Bible. But you can see where that particular point of view can affect somebody's faith. And that's what I want to address here, is what effect can something like this have on people's faith? Can it tip your cow over? Can you picture that? Can it upset your confidence, your belief system, to hear things like this, not realizing really what's going on? The pagan religions, most of them, many of them, at least in the what they call the Abrahamic faiths, those were ultimately from Noah and Abraham until the time of Moses. Now, at the time of Moses, God began to work with those people to create out of them a holy nation. I'm not saying they did well in that department. I'm just saying that was the intention, to make a holy nation and to give them his laws in a codified form, to make a covenant with them as to how they were to live their lives from that point in time. But there were parallel religions along at the same time, people not being called in that way. They just simply carried on with what they were given. They drifted off into other ideas. Pagan, but they had a source. They didn't just make it up on the spot. Some of the ideas that they carried forward had a legitimate origin in antiquity. So let's understand that about paganism, and let's understand that when we see something like that, when we find, for example, in the Parthian religion, and I spoke on that recently, Zoroastrianism, elements that we wouldn't expect to find there. The Parthians were monotheists. They understood judgment after death. They had somewhat of a concept of heaven and hell. They were messianic. How could that be? Zoroastrians, weren't they pagans? Jesus Christ sent his apostles to the 10 tribes that were scattered abroad. Why? Because they were fertile ground to receive the message. Because there were elements already in place that were carryovers in their belief system. And where did they get their belief system? When the 12 tribes of Israel divided into 10 tribes and 2 tribes, the 10 tribes were carried into Assyria. Assyria was taken over by Babylon. Babylon was taken over by the Persians. And then the Greeks. And those are 3 of the heads that Nebuchadnezzar saw on his dream that he had. But in time, those people, the 10 tribes, conquered that region and were the empire called Parthia for nearly 500 years. Who were those people? Well, they were the descendants of the 10 tribes. They had their own priesthood. They had their own belief system. And that belief system included many biblical ideas that we wouldn't expect in a so-called pagan nation. Well, they weren't entirely pagan. Why did the Parthian elites come to Jerusalem year after year to keep the feasts? Why did they come seeking the Messiah? They knew about that. They had preserved a lot of their old teachings from before the time the nation divided. So when we find elements in the so-called pagan Parthian religion that have found their way into Christianity, it isn't that we borrowed from a pagan nation. That isn't what happened. There were elements left over that were true, the points of truth, that would be points of truth at any time. That wasn't necessarily the source. But you can see where people who look into where we got our religions could recognize elements in that region of the world that predated Christ. And that is profound when you think about it. But realizing how it happened, it's very logical. But what I found concerning is that people can consider these kind of things thinking that, oh, we just borrowed this from that religion, we borrowed that from that religion, we borrowed something, and we put it all together and made a new religion out of it. That's not what happens. And it shouldn't upset anyone's faith to see that comparison. So just a point that we need to be concerned about, that we need to be aware of, lest it upset our belief systems. Let's go back to the earlier years and think about the book of Job. A fascinating book in the sense of what the time frame was when that happened. Job, in all probability, lived about the time of Abraham. And in the book of Job, we get a narrative of what the belief system was in his day. And a lot of it is very good. Where did Job get his understanding? Well, he's a righteous man. He may have had direct communication with God. We don't know. But the point is, he was an exceptionally righteous man. God had to test him in another area to perfect him more. But his belief system and those of his so-called friends around him said some very profound and correct things. Job didn't have the Torah. What Bible did he have? Where did he learn what he learned? Job's time was possibly 400 years before Moses. That's quite a span of time. And it's time for ancient belief systems to develop. We know about Abraham. He had direct interactions of the true God. He was the founding father of an entire ethnic line. And that ethnic line had a new component added into their belief system, that being the objective of redemption. Not just worship. The pagan religions worship. But what do they think about the idea of redemption, if we understand what that involves? Redemption. Were other nations offered redemption? Where? Abraham obeyed God's laws and taught them. And Abraham had many other descendants, the father of nations. He had his son Ishmael by Hagar and Isaac by Sarah. And after Sarah died, he remarried Keturah and had six more sons. Isaac had twin boys, Jacob and Esau. Jacob had 12 sons. The God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, they all learned from a credible source, and we shouldn't dismiss it. Not that they stayed on track theologically. That isn't the point. Now, Jacob's 12 sons, they grew up, or they developed their religious orientation under Egyptian cultural influences. And they were all dead by the time of the Exodus. They were some 10 generations during their Egyptian sojourn. Some of them were good years. Towards the end, we know how bad it got. But that was another reason, I suppose, that God would allow the elderly people in that Exodus contingent to die off. They were deeply rooted in their Egyptian culture and belief system. And this may tip your cow over, but they weren't Jews. They weren't practicing Jews. That belief system hadn't even been formed yet. Look at what happened when they got concerned about Moses. We haven't seen him for a long time. What did they do? They reverted back to something they understood. The golden calf incident. Why did they do that? Because that was their orientation religiously. They grew up in it. For a couple of centuries, they grew up in that. Now, people can become unnerved by the suggestion that not all of the words in the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, were written exclusively by Moses. That's a founding belief. That's a favorite traditional position with many people. Might be true. I'm not here to say it's true or not. That's not my point. My point is that the suggestion, with evidence that people present, can overturn people's faith. If your faith is based on something like that, what does it do? That's what we need to be prepared for and to know how to handle. There's much evidence that there were many writers of the first five books of the Old Testament. For example, how did Moses know all of the details presented in the book of Genesis? That was all before, long before his time, centuries before him. Someone had to carry that information forward to where he could take it and compile it into what we know as the book of Genesis. How did Moses write Deuteronomy? There are people who say, and I don't know if they're right or wrong, it's not my point, there's people who say that Deuteronomy, which is the second giving of the law, Deuteronomos, the second law, was written much later. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, I don't know. Some say that it was written after 600 B.C. Not the point. And we need to get away from that. The real point is that God could inspire various writers to produce a consistent, accurate account that agrees. They're all on the same page. That, to me, that God would inspire multiple authors to be saying the same thing is a more potent idea than simply that one person wrote it all. Doesn't matter to me if it was or wasn't. I'm just looking at that old cow. Is it standing on all fours or it's on its side? What reaction do people have to such suggestions? There's a general idea that Moses wrote it all in perfect Hebrew, even though Hebrew was in a stage of development for many, many centuries. We have Paleo-Hebrew, which was writing that bears little resemblance. We have ancient Hebrew. We have Biblical Hebrew, which was pretty well developed by that time. We have modern Hebrew that bears little resemblance to ancient Hebrew in many respects. What form do we look to as being the right one? Does it really matter, or does it matter what it says? That's the bigger issue. Whether these ideas are correct or not, what matters is the impact it has on people's faith. Now we could ask, and this is well known in the theological world, why did Moses write using three different narrative styles? If you've ever looked into this, you'll hear that there were narratives that they call the J narrative. There are other narratives that they call the E narrative. And then there is a lesser one that they call the P narrative. The J narrative is the one where the writer uses the term Jehovah most of the time, if not always. The E narratives are where the writer uses Elohim for God, most if not all of the time. And then the P narratives were written, obviously, by someone in the priesthood. This is how they analyze the writings. Someone compiled all those together. It's most evident in the book of Exodus. You read Exodus, it's not chronological. You're reading along, and then it stops, and it jumps back, and then brings some other narrative up, a parallel narrative, to cover the same ground. You just can't look to the book of Exodus as being chronological, strictly chronological, which attests to the fact that someone took various writings and compiled them together in a complete and logical manner. who wrote it. It's not my point to argue that. I don't really care. What I care about was what it says. What I care about is, were all of these words inspired? If they were, there's our answer. But what do such things do to people's faith? If we've based our faith on a particular idea, what do we do when certain realities are presented to us by scholars in the world? It can happen. Look at Moses' life. Moses was raised and educated, steeped in Egyptian culture. Moses was brought up from infancy as an Egyptian. And he, in that sense, taught what language? What language did Moses speak in his Egyptian environment? He commanded an army. He must have spoken the language of his troops. Was he bilingual? Could have been. Probably was. But Moses was a favored Egyptian prince most of his 40 years in Egypt. Moses didn't go home to Amram and Jochebed every night for supper. He lived in the palaces. He was among the elite of Egypt. They spoke Egyptian. What language was common among the children of Israel in Egypt? Did they insist on a different language? Did they make their taskmasters speak the language that they preferred? Or were they, by circumstance, forced to speak Egyptian? There is a body of beliefs that have been identified, and this is said of the Parthian religion, that it affected the Abrahamic religions. And what were they? The Abrahamic religions were Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Those were the peoples of Abraham, and their religions are considered the religions of the Abrahamic families. They have certain similarities. Not any one of them is completely the truth, even Christianity. There's a lot of stuff brought in that doesn't belong. Not saying true Christianity, I'm just saying Christianity in general incorporates a lot of religious ideas that are brought in from the pagan world as well. But one thing about the Parthian region of the world is that because of its belief system, because of the latitude that it had taken, because of its Israelite heritage originally, it was more amenable to accepting the gospel message that Jesus Christ brought than were his own people. He went to his own, and his own received him not. He didn't get a good reception among his own kind. He said of himself that he was sent to the lost tribes of Israel. He sent his disciples out with the same to take his message to the tribes, not to the Jews necessarily. So that culture was more amenable to accepting the message that Jesus Christ gave than were his own Jewish people, who were locked in their belief system to where they couldn't even accept the fact that he was their Messiah. Wouldn't have it. They killed him for the suggestion even. So can we get the picture of our religions? Hopefully this will present that to you, the fact that there was an original teaching, and through population dispersions, it dispersed among various cultures. And then when the time came, many of the truths that were still sprinkled out here and there were brought back together as a convergence. We could call that a subtitle of this message: Roots, Divergence, and Convergence. That's sort of what happened. And that's how we got where we are today. But we're going to find things that are somewhat upsetting when we look at all the facts of how things came about. Now, we talked about earlier that Moses at first didn't know certain things. He didn't know the name at first. That came to be later. When did he do that? The account of that is found in Exodus 33. And this is quite late. This is that point in time where he had broken the tablets, the Ten Commandment tablets. And he hadn't seen God in his glorified form. And he asked God for permission to see him in his glory. We can begin the reading in Exodus 33:17-23. And the Lord said unto Moses, I will do this thing also that you have spoken, for you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name. And he said, I beseech you, show me your glory. And he said, I will make all my goodness past before you, and I will proclaim, notice this, I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you, and will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. And he said, you cannot see my face, for there shall no man see me and live. And the Lord said, behold, there is a place by me, and you shall stand upon a rock. And it shall come to pass, while my glory passes by, that I will put you there in a cleft of the rock, and will cover you with my hand while I pass by. And I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen. Continuing on in chapter 34. And the Lord said unto Moses, hew two tablets of stone, like unto the first. So this gives us the point in time when this event happened. And I will write upon these tables the words that were in the first tables, which you broke. And be ready in the morning, and come up in the morning unto Mount Sinai, and present yourself there to me in the top of the mount. And no man shall come up with you, neither let any man be seen throughout all the mount, neither let the flocks nor the herds feed before that mount. This was a special moment in time. And he hewed two tables of stone like unto the first, and Moses rose up early in the morning and went up into the Mount Sinai, as the Lord had commanded him, and took his hand the two tables of stone. And the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And what did he say? Verse 6. And the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, this is what he said, Yahweh, Yahweh, Elohim. Merciful and gracious, long-suffering, and abundant in goodness and truth. I'm suspecting that that's the first time that Moses became acquainted with the name Yahweh, Jehovah. If so, what a profound consideration that at that point in time, not only did he utter the names, but contained within it is a vital understanding that we have, that many religions don't, that there are two Jehovahs in the Elohim. Do you see it there? a two-being Godhead. What do we do with such things? The point is here, I've brought to attention to many different things. We sometimes make presumptions, and they're logical. They're certainly logical. Some are provable, some are not. But what does it do to our faith when we discover something that's a little different than we might have thought? How much does it matter? How much does it matter to us that our understanding is perfect or not? Or that there's more to learn? What does it do to our faith? We need to have our faith built solid, because events like this will happen. Somebody's going to come to your cow and over it goes. And they're going to laugh. It's so funny. What do? We need to be prepared. That's what we do. We need to prove all things. We need to anchor deep in the things that are good and provably solid. 1 Thessalonians 5:21 tells us, prove all things. Hold fast that which is good. We don't want to make assumptions that are questionable. It can happen. Any one of us can do it. I'm sure each of us can come up with something where we've done that. We need to have our faith anchored deep. That's the important thing. We need to stay awake. We need to stay prepared. For cow tippers will come.